Hey everyone, thank you for joining me on the BIPOC Outside podcast. I'm Chris Cromwell, and today we're sitting down with Ellen Bradley. Ellen is a Tlingit scientist and professional skier whose work brings Indigenous perspective to both climate science and the outdoor industry. So let's get into it, shall we? Ellen, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well today. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing pretty good too. So let's jump into it. You are a Tlingit woman with homelands in Southeast Alaska, but you were born in the Puget Sound area. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So tell me about, as a young person, you getting out into the outdoors.
Yeah, so growing up in the Pacific Northwest, obviously the outdoors are all around me. We have pretty great access, especially compared to a lot of places in the United States. But my parents got me and my brother, who was older than me, into skiing when we were pretty young. I think they both got into it in their early 20s, in their early adulthood, living in Washington and seeing the Cascades. I think that they were drawn to the mountains and wanted to try it out. And the second they had kids, they're like, this seems like a really important thing to get our kids into, to spend time outside. Growing up, I spent a ton of time out in the mountains skiing and then got more into hiking in high school. Spent a lot of time on the water, just as you do growing up in the summers in Washington. And then just, yeah, over my lifetime, I realized spending time outside is something that feels integral to who I am and very important in this world. And I learned that not a lot of people had that same access or those same experiences growing up.
In a former interview, you said skiing allows you to connect with your Indigenous identity as an activity that forces you to be intentional outside. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I think skiing in general can be this really beautiful tool to have a reason to go outside. I think it's really hard for us these days, especially with the advent of phones and social media, to be drawn outside in the same way that we were when we were kids. At least for me, when I was a kid, I grew up in that generation where my parents just let us roam the neighborhood and run around with friends. And I feel really lucky that I didn't have a smartphone until I was in late high school, early high school, but still, I felt like I had a childhood outside. And I think in growing up, I didn't really realize that skiing was that for me, because being outside was so much more common. But the older I've gotten, as I went into college, as I've gone into adulthood, post-college, I've realized that you feel like you have less excuses to go outside in this very colonized, capitalistic world. And I think that skiing or other outdoor recreation can be that really good excuse to go outside, to be intentional, to be this vehicle to spending time with the land. And I think for me, skiing has just become that because I fell in love with skiing. I love spending time outside in the winter. I love being on the snow. I love moving really fast in landscapes. But as I moved from resort skiing to backcountry skiing was where I really felt that intentional nature coming more into place within skiing and felt my connection deepen in the places that I was spending a lot of my time skiing.
I promised our mutual friend that I wouldn't spend the entire show geeking out about this, but in my academic world, I work on what the academy would call subversive methodologies, anything that's non-standard. And going back through some of your academic writing, you said that you use ski touring as a methodology, and my brain exploded. So before we start talking about the outdoors, can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have a background in ecology and research and field work, and I spent a lot of summers of my life thus far doing field work in a specific place. And a lot of the very scientific methodologies that go into field work are very slow, as I'm sure you know, in the academy. Research is typically a very slow activity, and so much of what we perceive of skiing is like, it's this really fast thing. You're moving down the mountain super quickly. So often we're tracking how fast we can move or how many laps we can do in a day. And I think that country skiing specifically has been more of this really similar methodology to me that field work was, where it took this activity that I loved, skiing, spending time outside with the land, and really slowed it down. Because when you backcountry ski, you spend the majority of your time moving uphill. I don't even know what the numbers are on how much faster you move down compared to how slowly you move up the mountain, how many times more you spend moving uphill, but it just completely changes the activity and slows it down. And for me, that became this methodology of connection, of building relationship to place, especially with the inherent relatively inherent nature of backcountry skiing, where you are moving up a landscape. As you're moving up an altitude, you are changing the types of landscape, the type of ecosystem you are interacting with. And to me, that felt like a really important thing that I realized over time, was that I was building my relationships up a mountain, and that allowed me to then have a better relationship with the mountain as then I came back down it, right? And I think that's something that not a lot of people may think about in the way that they're connecting with the land. And like, I don't really think it matters how long your ski tour is, or if you think you are visually moving through different landscapes, every step you are taking, you are building a new relationship with a different part of the mountain. You are introducing yourself. It is meeting you for the first time, or maybe the 1,000th time if it's in ski touring, you've done a lot. But it's a different ecosystem. And I think thinking of it in that way and spending a lot more time moving slowly on the mountain really allowed me to sit more in my indigenous values and perspectives that tell me everything that I'm interacting in the world has spirit, has value, has its own personality. I think you see that a ton when you are moving slow. Whereas if you're just going to resorts, you may think, oh, they're all pretty similar. I don't see as many of the differences as I think you do when you go on different backcountry tours and you can experience it. But especially if you come into it in the right mental framework, because I don't think that everyone approaches a backcountry skiing that way or has the same experiences. But I think a lot of people feel what that feels like and maybe don't have the words or the world view understanding to recognize what it is that they're feeling.
I think that's maybe a difference between I wanted to talk about extractive tourism, and I wanted to talk about not just tourism, like going far afield, going to Alaska. We're going to talk a lot about Alaska, but even being a tourist in your own space, and that ability to be extractive gets totally minimized once you have a relationship with that space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like one of my favorite ways to conceptualize that is if you recognize yourself as a part of anything, it is very hard for you to extract from it because you will recognize how you're extracting from yourself. And so putting yourself in the ecosystem and recognizing, oh, when I step here, I make an indent with my ski, I start a new skin track, and that's going to leave an imprint that when the next snowfall comes, you can still see my footprints of my experience here and recognize, oh, I bet other animals who come through here could see this too. And think about, oh, maybe a human moved through here. Maybe the trees see that, or maybe that changes the depiction of how water and is moving through that system in the winter into the different plants. I think the second you recognize yourself as an integral part of the ecosystem and the impact you have, the less you are to go on that backcountry tour and be like, when the summer comes, I'm going to completely log this place, because you're recognizing the role that you play in the world. And I think that like outdoor rec can be a really cool vehicle for people who don't have their own cultural background to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of science that shows that people getting involved in unstructured outdoor sport makes them more aware. This is political science, and will vote strategically in terms of environmental initiatives. So it's like something that is culturally understood because of the indigenous worldview. But like every other thing that we see in traditional indigenous science, eventually the Western world comes around to going, oh yeah, no, that's true, and we can validate it.
Yeah, I think that arc of Western science or Western understanding of the world is such a fascinating one to me. It was one that I had this really big realization about in an environmental ethics course in my undergrad, where essentially we spent the entire semester like reading environmental texts throughout time, starting with Plato, Socrates era, moving into the present. And the like overarching thing that I took from the course is like, throughout white history, there's been this arc that's like, slowly but surely, we're going to include more things into the community of things that matter, that we consider to have value. And it's, oh, we start with just like white men, then like white men who own land, and then like maybe women have rights, and then, oh, perhaps like sentient beings, like other animals that have like feelings and can feel pain, like maybe they matter. And slowly but surely, but at first it's, oh, fish don't matter, right? Because their nervous systems are different. And then new science comes out where it's maybe fish do feel pain. And then it's okay, trees and plants don't matter, right? Because they don't feel things. And now there's science where we understand that trees do feel pain. And so that arc is just like over time in regard to Western science understanding of the complexities of life. We're slowly but surely including more things to be like, this matters. It has meaning, it has value, and it therefore should have its own ethics that we treat it with. In my brain, I was like, I just wasted an entire semester taking this course because where I come from, all of this shit mattered from day one, right? Well, I didn't need 500 years of white men doing science to learn that a fish matters or that it like doesn't necessarily sit significantly lower on the hierarchy of life than humans do. And it's just such a fascinating thing to me because I think we see it over and over again, the more research that comes out about different sentient beings and what they experience, like we just rely so much on that in the Western science understanding, whereas obviously in an indigenous traditional ecological knowledge understanding of the world, we have tens of thousands, 20s of thousands of years of experience of being integral in these communities that it's just hilarious to me how long it's taken then the colonial project to get to the point that it's at now and super fascinating. But I think, yeah, I don't even necessarily remember where I was going with this, but I do think it's like such a fascinating thing and something that like later in life, in my 20s, I came to and was like, holy shit, like I didn't realize how different my brain worked than the rest of my peers. And that's so rooted in my indigeneity in the way that I was raised, but I also just believe in my genetics and what my genetic product was able to tell me about the world, whether or not it was taught to me in a very traditional indigenous way.
I have the privilege of researching with and for indigenous communities. I'm not indigenous. I chose this field because as a Black person, my world was shaped by colonialism as well. So I wanted to work in a decolonial, anti-colonial space. No amount of research and study will ever give me an indigenous worldview. I completely understand that. But what shocks me and frustrates me, I'm like, indigenous people have been telling you this for thousands of years. Indigenous people have been telling the academy this for hundreds of years. Why are we now saying it's been discovered and why is that white man's name beside it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is where I was going that I got off track earlier was at the end of that semester, we had to write a paper about our own environmental ethic. And I essentially, in that paper, outlined to this white professor who was teaching the course, like how I thought this entire course was a waste of time, that my environmental ethic was not informed at all by any of these theoretical, philosophical people we uphold who are telling us what to believe, like how it was an absolute waste of my time to have read all of that and to think that any of those would have informed my environmental ethic when I came in with my environmental ethic and I left with it the way that it was when I came in. And just, yeah, again, so fascinating how the academy tries to claim almost the superiority of knowledge and of intellect. And I think it was something that even growing up, I thought existed. And slowly over time, the image that I had of the academy eroded for me. There's not much that I can really learn in these spaces that I may not already know in my own being or could go to my community and either learn or continue to learn and evolve. Yeah.
You have been incredibly vocal about extractive tourism, and I've appreciated that so much. That needs to be heard. That needs to be heard from voices that are informed from some of these spaces that are so continually extracted from. So yep. First of all, for our listeners that don't really have a working definition of what that means, can you explain it? And can you talk about it in terms of your own community?
So I think, in all honesty, the majority of tourism is extractive tourism. I think when we are traveling to a new place with a lack of reciprocity, with a lack of understanding of historical context of a place, of culture, of language, but especially when we're going to a place we are not invited, in many ways we're inherently extractive. And that's a pretty harsh statement to make because that's 99% of what is going on this planet when it comes to travel. It's something that I'm absolutely guilty of many times in my life. I'm a person who's interacted with this world and traveled to places that I was not invited to. And I think for me, that invitation is most importantly from the indigenous communities within the places that you are visiting. But in the context of what I've been talking about within extractive tourism a lot lately, that's in Alaska, and it's especially in ways that are exemplifying and uplifting these kind of very colonial narratives that exist within Alaska. And I think a lot of the underlying concepts of what I talk about when it comes to Alaska specifically are absolutely applicable broadly across the world and in many other communities. And I think some of the specifics of why I focus on it is because Alaska is, like, almost in a lot of ways more extracted than other places in the current time frame. I think a lot of these places went through this extraction in the past, and the extraction is continuing, but I think it's pretty obvious and it's very in our faces, especially within outdoor media and just historical context of Alaskan colonization. A lot of the specific actions that people take when they're traveling to Alaska are very frustrating. But again, a lot of it comes and is applicable to other communities. A lot of the frameworks that I get for understanding extractive tourism in Alaska actually comes from Hawaii and Kanaka Maoli and their understanding of travel to the islands, and having some really incredible mentors in my life who have taught and talked me through a lot of Kanaka perspectives of the outside visitors. A lot of it comes from Puerto Rico, from these colonized places that are also colonies of the United States. But for me, at the core of it, it's Alaska, because that's where I'm from, that's where my people are, and that's where I most closely identify as being home.
It's amazing that you say that, because when I see a lot of your writings, I see so many parallels to Indigenous thinkers like Hanani K. Trask talking about extraction in Hawaii. There's a lot of parallels there in terms of the outdoors. It's just in different seasons.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's looking at the differences between the different seasons, I think, was like a harder transition for me to make. But I, in college, was really fortunate to study abroad on this archipelago in the Caribbean off the coast of Panama called Bocas del Toro. And it was through this school that's called the School for Field Studies. They have schools all over the world, but they're like a study abroad program that's way more focused on, like, all right, we're going to do environmental work, we're going to understand perspectives in specific communities, what's going on in countries. And the specific program I did in Bocas was very much about extractive tourism in Bocas. Bocas is a set of islands where people, especially backpackers, party hard, very hard party islands. They have a thing called Filthy Friday that happens every Friday. That's a 3-island bar crawl where people are like absolutely doing the most heinous things, partying so hard and being so extractive to one of the most beautiful places in the entire world, this beautiful archipelago. And there are groups of indigenous peoples that still live on these islands within the archipelago. And it's this very crazy juxtaposition to have travelers from across the world coming in right next to indigenous communities. And that was where I think I really started to make a lot of these connections in my life, and what made me become really passionate about understanding tourism and how tourism impacts places. And over the years, since I spent my time in Bocas, I have come up with so many research projects that I want to do that I've never actually done. And one of them was, like, I really wanted to compare tourism's impacts on fisheries in Bocas versus in Southeast Alaska, and understanding, like, okay, as you were saying, the differences between seasons, but also the differences between climates. What is a tourist, or what is a quantifiable understanding of both, like, quantity and quality of, like, how tourists are impacting the fisheries in Alaska, where we're clearly struggling. There's so many issues associated with it, especially when it comes to charter fishing. But then also a place like Bocas, where people have such a demand for seafood when they're on the islands. And yet in a place like Bocas, because of how much overfishing there's been done, because it was such a popular place to travel for so many years, so much of the fish is actually coming from the Pacific side of Panama. And they're, like, completely transporting it across the country to feed to tourists. So they're having this quote unquote authentic experience of the islands. And I think that was one of the most impactful experiences that I've had in my life, being a part of that study abroad program, because we existed on the island. We were absolutely outsiders. There's some really cool organizations that the school works with. And then there's also some really big questions about why the school exists and what the impact the school has on the community. And I think it just really opened my brain up to how the movement that we have as humans now in this really colonial world impacts communities, how that is a product of colonization, and also like where that's really complex and nuanced because humans have always moved and humans have always traveled. So yeah, it just really got my brain going. And then over the years since then, I feel like it's just really opened my eyes up to being more aware and more interested in understanding human movement in places, human tourism, and how we interact with places that we don't live and are just visiting.
There is one really key difference, though, between these places where extractive tourism is unbelievably forefront in the global south versus Alaska, and it's the language. Hawaii is a paradise. Panama is a paradise. But Alaska is inhospitable and uninhabitable, which it has been inhabited since the dawn of time.
Absolutely. Yep. We've disproven the Bering Strait theory many a time. So disclosure, we did not come from Asia.
That's got to be, is that something that's thought of in the community, or do you just brush it off as like white people nonsense when they call Alaska inhospitable?
I think in a lot of ways, many people do. I think a lot of people think of, especially this term that we get around Alaska, the last frontier, and the very ridiculous reality show that was titled The Last Frontier. A lot of people in Alaska are like, this is absolutely ridiculous. This is not an accurate depiction of Alaska at all. This is so dramatized for TV. And I think that narrative is common across like indigenous and non-indigenous communities who currently live in Alaska.
And
I think a lot of people are actively perpetuating those stories at the same time. And I think that is very true within your outdoor media that we see. Is like a lot of people, I think the best way to describe it is if you picture in your head the mountain man, right? Like a guy with a huge beard who's just, I could do this all on my own. People like that do live in Alaska and they love to be like, yep, that's me. I'm that guy. I'm just the Alaskan. I'm the last frontier guy. I can do this on my own. And I think that it could be the exact same person who is both perpetuating that stereotype and those narratives of Alaska in their actions who also thinks that those depictions are stupid. And I think that's part of the reason it's really important to continue to have these conversations about this. And I say continue because I'm absolutely not the first person at all to bring these subjects up at all. There's so many people who have these questions about Alaska. And I think it's just a continuation into the outdoor industry because a lot of these conversations have been had about other things, about colonization, about different realms of how we're applying the last frontier. And it's just been less talked about within the outdoor industry spaces. And I say less talked about because the conversation around John Muir has been existing for a very long time. And that's very applicable to Alaska and especially to my homelands about how this man and his narratives impacted places. But I think it's a really important conversation to continue because I think so many of us may have good intentions and then be perpetuating these colonial narratives.
Yeah. And like the outdoor industry really needs to do some critical reflection on the language that they're using and where that language came from, because they didn't invent the untouched wilderness narrative, the inhospitable narrative. Like that was the narrative that underpinned Terra Nullius, how the church permitted colonialism to happen here on Turtle Island.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the other aspect of even just the term the last frontier, which more people would put more thought into, is the fact that it implies that there were many frontiers before it, right? That it was just this last one that was like, they met a boundary that they could no longer pass. And it happened to be, right? And I think that's what perpetuates these theories of inhospitability was like, okay, we haven't quite conquered this place yet. It's the last place we're still actively trying to conquer. And that's where my frustrations and outward frustrations, whether that's on Instagram or in articles or in the work that I do in the outdoor industry comes from, is it is this narrative that is a constant and an adoration of the active colonization and the active conquering of a place that theoretically everywhere else has already been conquered, air quotes, and that Alaska is active in that. And as a person whose people experience the other side of that, the active nature of that is absolutely true, and I don't want to be reminded of it every single day. I want to watch a ski film and be like, this is sick. Native people are doing their thing. Not watch a ski go and be like, I absolutely hate the ski industry.
Yeah. And it's so wild that people who will use this language of the final frontier or the violence of I've got to conquer this mountain or slay this objective or whatever, talking about basically actively, personally colonizing a space, will turn around on the other side of their face and say, oh, that happened years ago. Get over it. That was decades ago. Colonialism happened in the 1600s. Slavery ended 100 years ago. It's time for people to get over it while actively participating in it.
Yeah. And they don't see how they're active participants of it. And their understanding of the time frames in which these things happened and are happening are so false. Like, when my grandma was alive, segregation existed in Southeast Alaska. Like, my grandma. That's yeah. not that long ago. Like, she would go to the movie theaters with her Tlingit mom and have to sit behind chicken wire. Like, that's not that long ago, and people don't understand the time frames of these things, how they exist within many people's living memory or the living memory of our elders who are very recently passed.
Yeah.
And so that's a frustration, absolutely, of the people who do use the arguments of, oh, that happened a long time ago, get over it. Or even the people who think that in their actions, they're somehow pushing the narrative or progressing. That's where a lot of my frustration comes from, even more. Because I think the narratives of it was a long time ago, get over it, is something that we've probably all heard our whole life. And so at least it's something that, like, it's a perspective that I have a better understanding of because I'm used to it. But lately in the outdoor industry, and I think we've seen this a lot since George Floyd, since 2020, there was this push for DEI in spaces. And one of those pushes that I've seen that really frustrates me and leads me to feel like we need to have some serious conversations about what it is we're fighting for is the inclusion of people who were not traditionally included in these spaces, but they're being included in traditionally extractive activities. And we celebrate that. And that's absolutely not outdoor industry specific. Like, we see that with politics. We see that in the UN, right? A Black person raises their hand to say that we veto ceasefire. And that's like a whole, wow, a Black person did it, right? It wasn't a white person. But it's like a constant that we have in this world. If we just pander to the DEI that people want, of, oh, a white woman was in power, we can remove our ability and our need to have the nuanced conversations about, okay, but is this system actually just? Is this activity actually ethical? Because we can just point and be like, but people of color did it. That's so cool. Now I'm just going to send a bunch of white athletes to do it again, because we sent those couple people of color to do it. And that's my biggest frustration, is seeing that the industry is doing that and perpetuating this workaround within social justice movements, and that individuals are perpetuating it themselves. And they don't see the cog that they are to the system of, like, their participation in something being the reason we aren't actually getting real change. And that's a really hard frustration for me to have, because I'm totally a systems thinker. That's how I am as an ecologist. That's why I do the work that I do. I love the field work I've done, as I like to think of things from systems understanding, from a community-wide understanding. So it's really hard for me to apply those things to the individuals in these systems, because ethically I'm like, I know it's not the individual's fault. We're all products of the system. We're all doing the best that we can. We're all advocating in the ways that we genuinely probably think is going to make change. And to hold that, and to hold, okay, but you're still causing harm, and your participation in this excludes me from my voice being right. And it's definitely pitted me against a lot of other people of color in this outdoor industry space, where I think there's a lot of genuine feelings of threat on both sides, of feeling like each other's movements towards progress is actually pulling each other down. And I want to figure out what the right way to move through that is. But it's something that I've really struggled with, being in these places in the outdoor industry and watching a lot of people do things that I feel like are very unethical on my homelands.
How do I want to frame this question? Something that we do, that I do, is when trying to encourage and bring people out into these spaces, is come from the position, if we are not traveling with respect and reciprocity and reverence and understanding in Indigenous lands, then ultimately we're just becoming colonizers. This is something that I say in my community. Yeah. And so trying to educate and trying to find resources to do that, not for my own community, but also under this broader BIPOC umbrella. We totally tore apart the word BIPOC earlier in the season, which I loved. I was so ready for that conversation. What advice would you give for me, for us working here? What are things we absolutely have to stop doing, first of all?
Yeah, I think we need to stop sending athletes to Alaska. I think that's a really easy thing to do. I think we just need to stop, unless there's a real story, unless they're working with Native people. I just don't think that there's any reason for us to send a white or a non-Indigenous athlete to Alaska and film them. What's the point? What are we doing? What are we telling us? These people don't live there. And I think, like, more on the individual level, one of the most important things I think that we need to do is to travel more intentionally. And to me, that means educating yourself more on the history of the place before you go there. For me, that meant this past year, I went 2 years ago to Puerto Rico for a science conference, and I had some really intentional conversations with my friends who are Puerto Rican before going to the island, and got some really great recommendations on books to read to understand U.S. colonial presence in Puerto Rico. I meant asking multiple people about their perspectives and understandings of whether or not I should even be going, if it was ethical to go visit this conference. Understanding that a conference or that an event isn't an invitation from the community to go to a place, which I think can be a confusing thing for a lot of people. So yeah, I use that as an example to say it's something that I have to do myself when I go to other places. Also, I think it's just an important way to be a traveler is, like, genuinely, we probably shouldn't be traveling to places with nobody we know, especially if we don't have any understanding of the place. And I think in my communities being like my home communities, my tribal communities, but also communities being people in the outdoor industry, I think one of the easy fixes would be, okay, if you're going to come to Juneau, if you're going to do anything, like, you're going to visit Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, Walter Soboloff Building. We are going to read this book. We are going to donate some money to these ski programs to get the youth out on the mountain. You're going to bring some extra gear that you might have laying around, and you're going to give it to the kids. You are going to spend time on the land. You are going to not get on a charter and fish and take 50 pounds of fish out of the state with you. I think that the answers are way simpler than people think, and they take a lot of effort. And I think that's going to be the hardest thing in encouraging people to be better travelers, is it does take a lot of time. It takes effort. It takes intentionality. And in this colonial capitalist world we live in, those are things we have not valued or been taught to value. And so a lot of people just simply won't do those things.
We're going to talk more about your youth work. I'm really excited to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about your work as a scientist. You understand culturally the impacts, but you also understand from a science perspective the impacts of this extractive tourism, this chasing the next thrill. So talk to me a bit about that.
Yeah. So I feel like the majority, if I'm being honest, of my frustrations with tourism do come more from a cultural impact than they do from a scientific impact, or like a Western understanding of science impact. And I think that's because I do believe that individual actions are relatively small compared to the system. I think that what's more important, and maybe this is more of social science understanding of how our tourism impacts things, is especially within the outdoor industry and within these spaces where people have influence, where they are people that outdoor recreationalists look up to, they're the people setting the standard of what it is that we value and what we should be aspiring to do in our outdoor recreation activities. And so I think that the impact from that, and this is something that I understood on a social side, but it comes from the IPCC's 2019 report on the state of climate change in the world, is that social influencers have a significant impact on promoting carbon reducing activities, or on the opposite side of that, not promoting super carbon intensive activities. And so from the science brain Ellen perspective, reading that in the IPCC report, I think about skiing, I think about heli skiing in Alaska. Heli skiing, getting on a helicopter, is like pretty carbon intensive activity. There are absolutely more carbon-intensive activities out there. My argument does not lie on the specific numbers of the carbon emissions associated with one individual going heli-skiing one time. Mine is more, again, as I talked about earlier, systems thinker of the impact that has when the person who is doing that activity and is promoting it as the standard of what you should be seeking out in skiing, the impact that has on carbon emissions of not only this one individual going out and heli skiing, but if they're doing it in a way that other people find out, they're probably bringing other people, they're bringing cameras, they're extracting these photos and videos from the place, and then you're encouraging other people to do it. And I can't tell you how many times I've been in the airport flying to Juneau or flying home from Juneau, and there are a group of people, usually groups of white men, in the airport talking about how they're going on a heli skiing trip. They're not from Alaska. They're flying to Alaska to do it. And that is where I feel like I see the majority of the impact of these kinds of activities that we are promoting in the outdoor industry is less with the individuals who are doing it and more with the wave that it breathes into the industry of what we should be doing and how many people that brings in. And I think, again, it's not isolated in skiing. I see that in the same way in the summer when I go home to my homelands and there's a bunch of white men going to go fish in Alaska and bringing fish out. Like, it's a product of these systems and the extractive nature of how we relate to the world. And I think the impact that skiers have on creating the new normal is much bigger than in other industries. And that's, I think, why I focus a lot of my impact in the outdoor industry is thinking about it from a physical and social science understanding of how we as people impact culture and social norms and how that has a much wider and broader impact than us as individuals. And that for whatever reason in skiing and in some other outdoor rec activities, we do uplift individuals to tell us what is cool. And therefore, those individuals could be changing the narrative and therefore changing the entire culture about what is cool with skiing.
Thank you for that. You've articulated so beautifully something that I've thought on a lot, but didn't really have the language for. It's like something becomes popular on Instagram and then it becomes another checkbox on all the tech bros list. It's got to have a jet boat, got to have a fast car, got to go heli skiing in Alaska. Check, check. That means I've made it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I see that so much anywhere I am, even if it's not like I'm going to Alaska. I'm like, I don't know. I can't tell you how many people I've met this year. And they're like, oh my God, I'm going to go to Alaska later this year. And I'm going to go heli skiing, or I'm going to be a heli guide. And it's so pervasive that, yeah, it is. It's a problem. Like, it's the tech bros, but it's even more than that, of this whole culture that we've created of, yeah, we just need to check these boxes. This is what's cool, without a societal level, like, questioning of, is this actually cool? Why are we doing this? Why do we think that if we're guides, going to Alaska means we made it as a guide? Like, why couldn't guiding on the place you've grown up and lived your whole life and have a better understanding than anyone else be cooler? Like, why do you need to go to another state you've maybe never been to on lands you've never experienced and think that you're going to provide tourists a good experience?
That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. It's been something that's been really hard for me to wrap my head around. And it's therefore really hard for me to have conversations with people about, like, when people come up to me and they're like, hey, I'm a guide, I'm going to go do guiding in Alaska. I don't know what to say to them in response, especially if they're like, do you have any advice? Or like, how can I be a better representative of your community? I really struggle with those because, again, on one hand, I'm like, at the end of the day, you're just a worker. Like, I can't blame you as an individual that much because you're just trying to make money. You're just trying to exist in this colonized world. You're just trying to pay yourself and find some meaning in what you do day to day. And on many levels, I 100% understand that. And then at the same time, I'm like, but also, why are you perpetuating this thing? And the answer to that's probably never really thought about it at that deep of a level. And again, it's, can you really blame people for what they don't know? I'm not sure. Sometimes I feel like yes, and sometimes I feel like no, you can't. It's a struggle that I constantly am having in this industry. There aren't a ton of Alaska Natives in this industry. There are a handful of us. There's a couple other people that I can talk to you about these things with, and we can try to navigate some of these conversations that we are frequently having to have. But there's absolutely not the same number of us as there are as white athletes in this industry. And it's so much of the money that's being made in this industry comes off of our land.
It's mind-blowing. And I ask myself the same question. Can I blame people for the things they don't know? And then I think that understanding the structural nature of it, which is where I tend to lean, is that they've eroded the education system on purpose so that people don't critically think about these things to drive a capital engine. And I know that sounds a little conspiracy theory, but that's the way I feel about it.
And I don't think it's necessarily even conspiracy theory. I think we've seen the roots of capitalism comes from trying to figure out how much labor you could extract from a slave before they died. Literally, they were just like, okay, but what if they only get 3 hours of sleep? Can they still work as hard? Like, where is the threshold of like how much they can work and produce? And I agree 100%. It's intentional that people do not know these things. The education system is a product of capitalism to keep people in capitalism. And it's like when you understand that, when you get to the education part of yourself within your own little communities where you read and learn where capitalism comes from, literally slavery, and not just like slavery and the like, oh, we were all educated on slavery as kids thing, but the actual roots and the actual occurrences of what slavery is and what happened and what is still happening, like, how do you be a cog in that?
Yeah, it's hard knowing all of these things and still being in the academy, but my objective at this point as an older person with a little bit more flexibility in my life ways is I'm just going to be a thorn in your side.
Yeah, absolutely.
The decision I make.
I totally understand that. And I think that's something that I put a lot of thought into because right now I'm not actively working in a science role. And it's the first time since my undergrad that I don't have a job in some capacity as a scientist. And I've put a lot of thought about continuing education, going, getting my PhD. And there's a part of me that's explored this outdoor industry ski world thing because in a lot of ways it felt different. And I do think that the impact that I'm able to have in the outdoor industry is a lot faster than it would be in my research. And at the same time, I'm just like, no, it's all the same. Like, it's the same system being in this industry as it would be being in the academy. And that's been a really fascinating thing to come across because I think growing up, you watch like X Games and stuff. And you're like, that's so out there. That's so different than what societally we are told to do. And then you get into those worlds and meet people that you've looked at on TV and looked up to in the ski world. And you're like, oh, no, we're all just fucking cogs in the system. That's been a really fascinating thing to experience, especially with so many of my other BIPOC friends. Again, I also don't know how I feel about the BIPOC designator, but so many of my other friends who are not white in these industries and talking with them about like where it is that we're pulling into the industry, where we're trying to change it from within, where we're trying to criticize it. And the more that I've had those conversations, the more I'm like, I would be having these conversations no matter if I was in the sciences or if I was a skier. It would just be the specifics of the conversation would be slightly different, but the conversations would be the same.
Absolutely, they are. The one thing with hosting this show is getting to talk to BIPOC athletes, organizers, activists in the outdoor space. And that, I think this is the one thing that gives me hope. It's an absolute privilege for me to get to sit and have these conversations. It assuages some of the frustration I have out in the broader world. And it's talking to leaders with actual cultural capital going into their communities and making positive change. And you're doing that. So tell me about the youth work you're doing in Alaska.
Yeah. So the root of the youth work that we're doing in Alaska right now came out of this first ski trip that I did to my homelands. I spent my summers growing up in like Ketchikan area off and on. And so I'd spend a lot of time on my homelands, but never skiing. And obviously skiing is my thing. It's what I grew up with. It's my connection point to the land. Growing up away from my traditional homelands, it was the way that I built relationships with ecosystems. And so I really wanted to go ski at home for the first time and do it in my way, in the Klinkit way, in the way that felt ethical, in the way that felt like I'm going to build relationship with these places. I'm going to listen to the land, and I'm not just going to do the like average skier goes to Alaska trip. We're going to flip that on its head and we're going to do it my way. So all this work came out of that and going home and skiing for the first time and being like, damn, there's not a lot of us out here at all. And not that was necessarily like a huge shock. I pretty much expected that going into it. I've lived in this world. I've been a skier. I have an understanding of demographics of who's on the mountains typically. But I think the thing that was really shocking is like skiing at Juneau at Eagle Crest is like relatively affordable compared to skiing at other places. Lift tickets are nowhere near as expensive as any of the big resorts. The Desperado. Exactly. It's not Colorado at all, which is also funny when you think of like the way we depict skiing in Alaska, that it would be more relatively, again, relatively, because skiing is always expensive, but relatively more affordable. But yeah, lift tickets are less expensive. The drive from downtown Juneau to Eagle Crest is 20 minutes. Like, that's pretty close. Juneau's not a mountain town at all. It's the capital of Alaska. It's a little city. And then it feels like a mountain town where you're super close to the mountains. And just being like, damn, like, if there was a place where Native people should have extreme easy access to skiing, you would think it would be here. Everything's happening on our homelands. All of these places are close. Yeah. And it just wasn't that way. There are a handful of other Native skiers and snowboarders out on the mountain at any given time. And I would be, I don't know, the science part of me is I really want to know what those numbers are. What is the percentage on any given day at Eagle Crest? But I could probably, like, on any day name and point out to you every single Native person on the mountain, and it would be a small number. And so in doing that first trip, and I really wanted to find a Tlingit woman to ski with. And at the time, it was really hard to find someone, especially someone who, like, was comfortable on the mountain and could show us around to some of the places that maybe we'd want to ski. And was just like, this is really frustrating. And I think this is an easy thing to fix. I don't think that this has to be like a really complex, nuanced thing that we have to completely dismantle systems in order to get people on the mountain. I think that this is something we can change. And secretly, not so secretly, I think by putting and getting more people on the mountain, that will be the source for system change of how we actually change these places. We started a little cohort of people who skied, people who were Native, who wanted to see some Native youth get out in these mountains, and started having conversations. It was me and Marina Anderson, who's awesome relative of mine, Katie Riley, who's an awesome ally living in Sitka, and a couple other folks who were just like, what do we do? How do we change this? Started having conversations. Shortly after our first trip, we came back for celebration, which is like the absolute best time to ever be in Juneau. It's when everyone comes home, click it, hi to Simpsons. It's what it sounds like, a big celebration. And we had a meeting with the, at the time, president of Sea Alaska, Anthony Malott. And we're like, Anthony, what do we do? Well, he's a skier, his family skiers. How do we get our Native youth on the mountain? And he looks at us and he's like, Douglas Indian Association started a program this winter. I didn't even hear about it until just recently, but this is happening. And the rest of us were like, that's absolutely incredible. This thing we wanted to strive to create already started and already exists. And eventually we got in contact with Benson Bullock, who runs that program, and had conversations with him about what he was doing. His program is specifically working with middle and high school kids and getting them on the mountains. They go quite a few weekends out of the year and have a pretty, I think they got a grant for the program, so they have a pretty decent budget to bring kids up. They give them lessons, lift tickets, rentals, lunch is provided by Sea Alaska. They try to get them as much gear as they can, and they're just like, take lessons, go ski, go snowboard, have fun. And we've had these conversations with him, and we're like, this is really awesome. Obviously, we want to build it out. We want to decrease barriers to accessing skiing for everyone of all ages, and also in many different ways of accessing skiing. And I, as a skier, have all these ideas and ways that I envision that being a possibility, but I really didn't want that to be completely driven by like my ideas of how I like to ski. And so we ended up putting together this Native Youth Snow Sports event last January, where we just invited the community in, played some Native ski films, and connected folks in the community with what resources already existed through DIA, through Eagle Crest, of how you could get on the mountain in a more affordable way. And we just simply asked people, what's missing? Like, where, as people in the community who are interested in skiing, what do you need? What other ways do you need to access this? And the things that we kept hearing over and over again was the elementary school kids, that Eagle Crest had some programs in general for getting kids out on the mountain, which are really awesome, but they're not Native specific. And we want Native programs by Natives for Natives, things that are just for us, spaces for our community to come together. And so that was the creation of this Native Youth Snow Sports Spring Break Camp that now I'm running with Tlingit and Haida with Central Council. And it's specifically for third through fifth graders in the Juneau area, but also in Southeast for tribal members. It just so happens that because it's during spring break, like, spring break in Juneau is one of the coolest times to be in town, because they're running this tournament called Gold Medal. And it's this basketball tournament where, like, all of the communities across Southeast are sending like village teams to come play basketball in Juneau. So a ton of people are already in Juneau, which means that theoretically, if a family is coming from Yakutat and is going to be in Juneau anyway, we can take their kids skiing or from Chico or from Ketchikan or Wrangell or wherever. And so the first year I ran it, super small program. We threw it all together really last minute, and I was able to take 8 kids out on the mountain, and we had a blast. But it was pretty small. This year, when we were putting together the planning, we were a lot more prepared, had a lot more time to work through the logistics and also be able to provide like some transportation, which we weren't able to get last year, which definitely limited our numbers, and also get registration out a little bit before gold medal so that people were less likely to have already registered for basketball during the week. And on the first day we opened registration, we had to close registration and create a wait list because we had so many kids apply and families just, again, as I said, because of gold medal, we had families from across Southeast who were like, I think we're going to be in town anyway. And so that's been super cool to be able to be a part of that and to see that program grow really quickly in 1 year, and also to see how much demand in town there was for getting kids out on the mountain. And because we do this work at Eagle Crest, it's a very small mountain. It's run by the city of Juneau, so it's very different than, as you said, the big resorts of Colorado. We are limited on our capacity to bring kids in because there's only so many ski instructors on the mountain at any given time. So that's, I think, going to be this next iteration of how we figure out how to get, not necessarily get around, but get around the fact that we don't have as many ski instructors as we have demand from kids. And so that might be something that I'm going to have to try to think through this summer of how we can maybe bring some people up to work camp next year, try to get more people in Juneau certified level one instructors, what we're going to do to adjust that. But that's been super cool. And then just like, on another note of kind of programming that's happening in Juneau, we have this internship through Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which is the nonprofit entity of Sea Alaska, the regional corporation for Southeast Alaska. And the internship was started last year, and it's with Mike James and Kanan Bossler, who work for the Coastal Alaska Avalanche Center /AELMP, which is the electric company in Juneau. And they mostly do like avalanche forecasting to make sure that avalanches aren't coming down on the power lines so that Juneau can have like power, which is hilarious. And they had this intern last year, Jocelyn Jackson, who was a senior in high school, and she's the most badass, most smart, wants to be a glacier scientist, like such a cool, awesome human being. And we just essentially were like, took her through an Airy 1, taught her how to navigate the mountain, taught her how to backcountry ski. And then she did some like research projects associated with that. And just based on circumstances, she ended up doing her first year of college at University of Alaska Southeast. So they actually brought her back. She's doing the internship again this year, which is so awesome. So she's just going to be like one of the most knowledgeable people on snow science, especially at such a young age, which is so awesome. But that's like a part of this whole equation and movement that we're building is we want people to access skiing however they want to. We want kids, we want elementary school kids, we want middle and high school age kids, we want college age kids to see that there's like actual careers that you could get out of this, whether that's in snow science or, I don't know, working on the mountain. There's so many different opportunities within that. And I think there's some next steps that we have in these big dreams that we have of building this community. Like, how do we get more access for adults who want to try or who already skied but still want to be able to access it? How do we create more opportunities for Indigenous skiers to get into the backcountry and try that out? Because some people don't want to ride at the resort. There's a lot of white people there. I don't like riding at the resort that much either. I would rather be in the backcountry with other Indigenous people. Or even aside from the downhill skiing, cross-country skiing is such a big thing in Juneau. Like, how do we build more community for Indigenous people there? And I think, I know that's a long story of how I got into the youth work, but that's where it comes from, is just wanting to build Indigenous community in a place like Juneau where skiing should be so accessible, and it isn't. And then recognizing that by breaking down some of these barriers, bringing people into these spaces, we're going to be able to have more complex conversations about what skiing is, where it is happening, why it is happening, how it is happening. And those conversations can be more than just me screaming into the Instagram void or me talking with my other Alaska Native friends who are skiers and snowboarders, that they can be community-wide conversations where multiple people's perspectives and opinions are being shared so that we can come up with the best solution and understanding of how we are going to let these things occur on our lands, or if we're not.
Well, and that's really how you change, how you shift the tide. These marketing campaigns of, oh, I'm going to have some Indigenous imagery or a visibly Indigenous person and put them in my marketing campaign, that's not going to change anything. But when we've got people at the decision-making table, whether it's in management or snow science or ski school, running ski school, teaching the next generation how to be on the snow, making decisions about every sort of aspect of how that entire organism is coming together, that's how you change, that's how you shift the tide.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I'm someone who so believes that change is so slow. It is too slow. It needs to be faster based off of like climate change, destruction of our planet. But it's a slow thing that has to occur over time because you are changing people's minds and changing structures. And I think that's why in the context of skiing, it can seem like this trivial thing that I'm getting really mad at people for doing on my homelands, right? And even in my head, sometimes I'm like, why am I getting mad at this? It's such a small thing. But it's because it's not a small thing. It's rooted in, like we talked about earlier, extractive tourism. Extractive tourism is rooted in settler colonialism, or not even settler, just colonialism in general. It's rooted in capitalism. It's rooted in all these systems that is destroying human capacity to live on this planet. And I think that there's a lot of work being done in some of the other realms of that, especially in Alaska. There's a lot of talk around fishing, around mining, around logging, these other extractive industries. And I haven't seen the conversation about the outdoor industry and how that impacts Alaska. And I think that's one of the main reasons I want to continue to have those conversations. And one of the reasons I get so emotional about it and feel the need to scream into the Instagram void about my perspectives of these skiers and what they're doing in Alaska is because there aren't a ton of people having these conversations. And I do think that these conversations are relevant in the grand scheme of how we change systems. And I do think that the solution to all this lies in land back. And I do think that land back is the ultimate climate solution. And if we were just given the land right now at Eagle Crest, we may not have the understanding of the outdoor industry pressures on a place like that. I think that we would do just fine at quote unquote managing it. But I think that there are these external pressures that it's important for people in my communities to have a better understanding of so that we can respond better to that instead of sub or unconsciously perpetuating that like so many people do, if that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. Yeah.
It's funny because I do think at the end of the day, skiing, I think it has so much meaning. And I do think it's the silly thing that we do, especially nowadays where if you're just skiing for fun, you're just skiing for fun. And I think fun is a wonderful reason to do something. But skiing can also be a vehicle to hunt or fish or travel or get food. It absolutely is this tool that is useful to human survival on the basics needs end. But I do think all of this is rooted and some really terrible things that have happened in these systems that are built to be very extractive and terrible. And that if there's anyone in Southeast Alaska who deserves to have a voice on what skiing is, it's my community. And right now we don't.
You've given me so incredibly much to think about. I know we're running into overtime. I want to ask you before I let you go, because I know you've got a number of projects on the go. Is there any that you want to tell us about? What's next? What's coming up?
Yeah, so I've been working on a film project about a lot of what I just talked about over the past, at this point, 2.5 years. It has been a roller coaster, and so I really don't know when it's going to come out or when it does come out, how much room we're actually going to have to explore a lot of these nuances, because originally I thought we were going to have a lot of room and then a funder fell out on us when we'd already started filming, and now we're without funding. Yeah, stay tuned for that and the hopeful release that will be this film project that has taken a lot of my time and energy and capacity for joy for the last 2.5 years. But yeah, I think that's mostly what I've been working on, and then hopefully expanding over the next few years what these ski programs look like on my homelands. There's some other programs I work on in the Lower 48 as well. Yeah. Mostly just watch me scream into the void some more until things change, because that's what things have been so far, is just me having a lot of conversations out on Instagram.
So where can our listeners follow you to watch you scream into the void? Are there links where we can support your work? Give me all the links.
Yeah, so my Instagram is Ellen G. Bradley, pretty easy to find. And then there's some links that I could send you that you could put maybe in the show notes for donations for our Native Youth Snow Sports Spring Break Camp. We started luckily this year, which is super awesome, the donation link with Tlingit and Haida, because a lot of our Native Youth programs are funded by grants or from government funding to the tribal entity. But the reason we need this program is because the ski industry exists on our land. So I think that the Native Youth program should be funded by the ski industry and not by my tribal government out of its own pockets. So I think that's where a lot of the support I need right now is just making sure that we have enough funding to keep running this program year after year, expanding it, what it looks like, making sure that the kids have the gear and the access that they need. Yeah.
Incredible.
And then hopefully at some point in time, this film will be out and widely accessible so that whoever wants to watch it can watch it.
When the film comes out, we'll definitely pump it out through all the social media. Listeners, you're going to find links to where to find Ellen, where to support this work, also including some of her work with Natives Outdoors, which we didn't get a chance to talk about. There's a lot of things on my list of questions that we didn't get to have a chance to talk about. I'm going to have to beg you to come back. This has been so incredibly generative, and thank you for your perspective. I've got so much to think about now. Really do appreciate the gift of your time.
Appreciate you lending me a space to scream into the void.
And that's it for this episode. Thank you everyone for listening. Links on where to find Ellen, some things we talked about, and some things we didn't get to are available on the show notes at BIPOCOutside.com. I feel like this episode gave me so much to think about. If you feel the same way, don't hesitate to smash the like button. I hope you'll join us again for another episode of BIPOC Outside.